We always recommend Shopify. It took us from an idea to a real business. We got set up, I think, in less than a day. With very little effort, we could just focus on the supply chains and the product development. Shopify gives us the ability to customize without the complexity. We can change something without introducing fragility or having to pay a developer. We're Thirsty Turtle, and we leveled up our business with Shopify.
Start your free trial at shopify.com/au.
Osterfreude für alle zum Aldi-Preis. Milka großer Schmunzelhase ab 90 Gramm für nur 1,29 Euro. Oder Philadelphia Frischkäse ab 150 Gramm für nur 89 Cent. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Newsflash. Remember that super cool book me and Carmen Carrion published called Freaky Folklore? Not only is it selling like pre-Cracker Barrel's absolutely stupid logo change pancakes, but I'm proud to announce that I personally narrated the audiobook, and it comes out in just a few days, September 7th, but you can pre-order it now. Just look for Freaky Folklore on Amazon or the Audible app, or you can click the link in the description and it will take you right to the audiobook. That's over 6 hours of Darkness Prevail's saucy voice describing the scariest monsters from around the world right in your ears. And yes, I pre-ordered my own audiobook. Thank you all so much for your support. Anyway, welcome back to Unexplained Encounters. Today's episode features an assortment of stories from cabin witches in the woods to giant humanoid bird monsters. Enjoy. I won't keep you waiting any longer. So, let's begin. Witch of the Woods. From Kokomo. My grandparents owned property in eastern Kentucky, about 40 acres of wilderness. Dad said we'd had it since the 1920s in our family, but I'm not sure about that. It was a two-bedroom cabin they'd built in the 50s, and though it was quite ramshackle, the land itself was gorgeous, with dense woods and a creek running through the bottom, mountains rising up on all sides. We would go up there every summer when I was a kid, spending a couple weeks running wild, while the adults sat on the porch and told stories. One story they never told when we were young was about the witch. I didn't hear about her until I was 17 years old, old enough that my grandpa figured I wouldn't get scared and do something stupid. We were sitting on the porch after dinner one night, just the two of us, watching fireflies come out. He'd been quiet for a while, then out of nowhere, he asked if I'd ever been up past the old fence line on the north side of the property. I hadn't. That fence was a good half-mile hike uphill through thick woods, and there was nothing up there worth seeing, as far as I knew, at least for a kid. Plus, he'd always told us kids to stay away from that area. Said it was too easy to get lost.
"Good," he said. "You keep staying away from up there."
When I asked why, he went quiet again. Then he told me about the woman who lived further up the mountain. According to my grandpa, there had been an old woman living up in those mountains since before he and grandma had the cabin built, back in 1951. Nobody knew exactly where her place was. The forest got too thick, and the terrain too rough to explore casually. But everyone in the area knew she was up there. And everyone knew to stay away.
"They called her a witch," he said, not quite looking at me. "Now, I don't know about all that, but I know she didn't take kindly to folks coming onto her land."
He told me that in the early 60s he had been hunting with his dogs, two blue tick coonhounds named Ranger and Duke. They'd gotten on the trail of something and taken off up the mountain before he could call them back. He followed their baying for a while, but the sound kept getting further away, heading up past the furthest he'd ever been before. Eventually, he had to turn back. It was getting dark and the terrain was getting dangerous. The dogs never came home. He went looking for them the next 3 days, calling and calling. Never found them. Never even heard them again after that first night. About a week later, he found their collars hanging on his fence post. Just the collars, nothing else. They'd been cut clean through with something sharp. "Could have been anyone," I said. "Maybe someone found them dead and was returning the collars." He shook his head.
"Do you listen to yourself? If you found someone's beloved pet, would you just rip the collar off and place them on the owner's fence post like a weirdo?" I don't think so. Plus, both of them dogs were young and healthy animals. I think something happened to them. Or someone happened to them. There were other stories. Hunters who went too far up the mountain and came back telling wild tales about being chased by something in the dark. A surveyor in the 70s, who was trying to map property lines and had all his equipment destroyed, found it smashed to pieces right where he'd left it. People heard things up there. Sometimes singing, other times screaming. Sometimes the screaming sounded like animals. Sometimes it didn't. But the story that really got to me was what happened in 1978. My Aunt Diane had come to visit with her kids, my cousins Becca and Anthony, who were maybe 6 and 8 years old at the time. They were staying for the weekend, sleeping in the main room on cots my grandma had set up. Everything was fine at first, but on the second night, around 2 a.m., both kids started to scream. Not the normal kid having a nightmare scream either, but this true terror, the kind that makes a loved one's blood run cold. My grandparents rushed in to find both kids huddled together on Becca's cot, pointing at the window and sobbing about the old lady who had been looking in at them. My grandpa grabbed his shotgun and a flashlight, running outside to look around. The window they'd pointed to was on the north side of the house, the side facing up the mountain. He didn't see anyone, but when he shined his light along the ground beneath the window, he saw blood, a lot of blood, pooled and splattered like something had been killed there recently. He got everyone into the back bedroom, away from that window, and stayed up the rest of the night with his gun. When the sun came up, he went back outside to investigate. The blood was still there, already attracting flies. Following the trail, he found a dead pig about 30 yards into the woods. Didn't look like a wild pig either. It looked like a domestic one, with its throat cut clean through. There was no explanation for how it got there. The nearest neighbor with pigs was miles away. But that wasn't the worst part. The worst part was what he found drawn in the dirt beneath the window. Symbols or letters or something. He couldn't tell what exactly, but deliberate marks made with a stick or a finger. And on the window itself, if you looked at it from the right angle with the morning sun hitting it, you could see handprints on the glass, small handprints, like that of an old woman. My grandparents packed up Diane and the kids that morning, sending them home early. And after seeing all that, Diane didn't argue. Everybody was scared. My grandpa said he had never seen my grandma so shaken up before. They tried to clean everything up, burning the pig's carcass and scrubbing away the blood. But 3 nights later, they woke up to a tremendous crash. A boulder, and I mean a proper boulder, probably weighed 500 pounds, had rolled down the hillside and slammed into the north wall of the cabin. It hit right where that window was, where the kids had been sleeping. The impact cracked the logs, broke the window, would have killed anyone sleeping there. My grandpa couldn't explain it. The rock hadn't been loose. He had walked that hillside 100 times and never spotted any loose boulders that size. It would have taken tremendous force to dislodge it and send it rolling like that. But there it was, embedded in the side of his house. "We thought about leaving," he told me that night on the porch. "Your grandma especially. But this was our land, our home, and nothing else happened after that. It was like a warning, I guess. Or like whatever business she had was finished. She wanted to hurt them kids. Never knew why." They did their best to patch up that wall. Back when I was a kid, you could still see the damage if you knew where to look. They also never let kids sleep in that area again. Partitioned it off like a storage room, nothing else. The Witch of those Woods. It was my family's legend, and to this day my theory is that those kids may have ventured too far out in the woods when nobody was looking, and they caught the eye of one pissed off witch. So for all of you reading or listening, be careful where you tread out in the forest. Some land is claimed, and some of those who claim it are evil people. Cagebound, from John O'Rourke. This happened during the summer of 1989, when I was 6 years old. I remember playing hide-and-seek with my brother and sister while on a family holiday. We found a field near our holiday home, so it was kind of isolated, ideal for hide-and-seek. There were a few rusted barrels around with sharp edges, and the grass was dead and yellow. There was something weird about the area. My sister went through the rules of hide-and-seek quickly, because I had a habit back then of peeking too soon or moving from one hiding place to another. My brother and I split up while my sister counted. I found a place behind a cluster of rusted barrels. All was silent for a while. Nothing but the cold Irish summer breeze brushing my hair and rustling the grass. The smell of the rusted barrel was so strong I could almost taste it. Little by little, I could hear my sister counting down from 20. Soon it sounded like she was heading my way, so I peeked up from the barrel. I caught a glimpse of her heading away from my vantage point at 10 o'clock. She'll never find me, I thought. And then I heard flapping sounds. I peeked up even more from the barrel and saw it. A cage door built into the wall across from me, secured with a brass lock. The next thing I remember is this tall, white, humanoid bird with a sharp yellow beak and ink-black eyes. When it saw me, it thrashed around and screeched, and those screeches are something I can still hear 36 years later. If you can imagine ambulance sirens piercing your eardrums, that's what it was like, and it was relentless. My presence really teed this thing off. Its beak was fixed open, and its ink-black eyes seemed to be popping from its skull. It looked like it was trying to break through the bars of the cage to get at me. Its beak got through. Eventually, it retracted its beak and began to flail around. It was thrashing and screeching and banging against the bars. Over and over and over. If that cage door hadn't been there, I wouldn't be here to tell this story. That thing was very strong. Its thick black talons made scraping sounds on the concrete floor of the enclosure, and it seemed to be jumping until I realized it was actually flapping its wings. I snapped out of it, recoiled, and screamed. I then ran away from my hiding spot. I turned around and saw its beak dive through the bars and pivot. I met back up with my brother and sister, who had now joined forces to seek. When they saw me, they asked why I was freaking out. I told them both what I saw. My sister rolled her eyes, and my brother asked if I'd imagined it. I insisted that what I saw was real, not my imagination. The three of us walked back to the cage. It was still there, but now it was empty. The floor was littered with feathers and what looked like scratches from the thing's talons. But the bars were not pried open and the lock was still in place. So, where had it gone? This is the best I can do, trying to remember something that happened so long ago. I do know this. It was not my imagination. It was no normal-sized bird. This thing was a tall, white, humanoid bird creature. I'm not sure if it's some cryptid or something more mythological. The jury is out on that. So what do you think it was?
Hey guys, it's Andrew from the Scary Mysteries Podcast, where every single week we dive into insane and creepy true crime compilations, as well as cover the most terrifying and strange news stories currently happening all around the world. As a true crime fan myself, we're covering all the topics you want to hear about. Missing persons, murders, poltergeists, UFOs, cryptids, and everything in between. I promise never to waste your time with any fluff or fillers in there. We just get straight into all the dark and scary insights to try and understand this strange world we all live in together. If you like true crime, then you're going to love us. So go check out the Scary Mysteries Podcast right now. I'll see you over there.
Did something follow me back to my dorm? From Y. Izong. I'm from a small state in the northeastern part of India called Nagaland. We are a tribal community with a primarily Christian population. This happened to me back in 2011, when I was a 17-year-old boy. Although I am a Christian, at the time of this story, I was not that religious, and I also didn't believe in paranormal stuff, but I did love a good horror flick. I'm not a good writer, but here we go. I was in the 12th grade, studying science at a government-funded college that also had 11th and 12th grade classes. Since the college was in a different district, 80 kilometers away from my home district, I stayed in one of the college's main dorms. The college was located in a village at the outskirts of town, and my dorm was a 6 to 7 minute walk away. I used to go home only during the holidays. One morning, I woke up a bit late for class, again. I hurriedly put on my uniform and rushed off to class without any breakfast. As the day went on, I kept feeling some kind of burning and itching sensation on my back. It was really uncomfortable, but I couldn't check it until 2 p.m. after all my classes were over. When the time finally came, I returned to my dorm, and I called some of my dorm mates in the same year, asking them to take a picture of my back with my phone so I could get a good look at it. Imagine my surprise when I saw 10 perfectly straight, thin scratch marks starting from right below my shoulders all the way down to the small of my back. While it wasn't deep or anything serious, it did break my skin, and there was a tiny bit of blood and some clear exudate already clotting over the scratches. That night after dinner, all 11 of us dorm mates from the same year stuffed ourselves into one of our tiny dorm rooms to discuss my situation. One of them suggested it could be a demon cat spirit that scratched me in my sleep. Apparently, it could have marked me and it would come for me again. I think this was one of the folklores from his tribe. Others suggested it was a spirit, ghost, or demon that could have attached itself to me during one of my walks back to my dorm after a late night outing. After class, I used to go out a lot to meet up with my friends from the neighboring dorms. We'd either hang out at their dorms or get a taxi to the town. Either way, at the end, it's always near or past midnight when I'd always have to do my 6 to 7 minute walk back to my dorm alone through one of two paths, both of which get very dark and very creepy at night. Some people here believe that if you return home very late at night, you're supposed to spit outside the doorway before you close the door and enter your home. Allegedly, this keeps anything that might be following you from entering. In the end, after all that discussion, we just laughed it off, saying that I probably did it to myself while scratching my back in my sleep, or something like that. I went to my room at around 11 or 12 p.m. to turn in for the night, not bothered at all about any spirits or ghosts. My roommate, who was a year below me, was already asleep, and so I turned off the lights and went to bed. After about 2 hours, I think, I suddenly woke up. I was sleeping on my back, and when I came to, my right hand was raised up straight. I could feel some kind of pressure on my wrist, like something was grabbing it firmly and pulling me towards it. The room was too dark to see anything clearly, being illuminated only by the moonlight barely coming through my curtains. However, I could faintly see a tall, dark figure standing by the bottom right side of my bed, holding and pulling my wrist. It was just black, fuzzy, and shadow-like. I couldn't make out any features. It took about 5 seconds for my groggy mind to process all this. The instant I realized what was going on, I got right up, screaming, and in one leap, I jumped onto my roommate's bed across the room, startling him awake. I turned and looked over at my bed, but the figure had already disappeared. Considering how unathletic I am, I was surprised I was able to make that kind of jump. I lay next to him under his sheets, shaking like a leaf. I quietly whispered to him, "What happened?" And he too got tense and scared. We were so terrified that neither of us were willing to get up and turn the lights back on. We lay like that in the dark under his sheets for what seemed like ages, all the while reciting the Lord's Prayer, even though we weren't very religious. When we finally started to calm down a bit, my phone, which I had left beside my pillow, began to get multiple text messages back to back, which made my heart leap. It wouldn't have mattered, but the edgy me at that time had set the message notification to something dark. So the notification sound was this high-pitched, evil-sounding voice screaming, "Sorry I have to yell, but you have a message from hell." Sure, the timing of the messages could have been a coincidence, but at the time, the already on-edge me and roommate couldn't take any more of it. We both tensed up, and fear shrouded us again. I was desperately wishing, "Please let this one be the last message." After one message, there would be a half to a second break. I would open my eyes, hoping, and suddenly the next notification would start playing again, making me jolt. This went on around 10 times. Eventually, it stopped. But now I could not let my guard down. Neither I nor my roommate could sleep, and we stayed like that, on his bed, till the morning light started to trickle in through the curtains, which was around 5:30 to 6 a.m. At last, I could hear some of the other students, who had started to wake up, going about their business in the corridor outside. I got out of my roommate's bed, went over to my phone, and checked the messages. They were promotional or ad messages from my phone carrier. I checked the time, and the messages had started to come in a little past 3 a.m. I got out of my room to wash up and get some breakfast. Although I had no intentions of letting the senior dorm mates, who were bachelor's degree students, know about my haunting, they did somehow find out. Right after breakfast, some of the dorm officials among the seniors came to my room, asking me to describe to them what happened. They looked around my room and saw the posters of metal bands that I had put up on my walls. I don't remember very well these days, but most probably they were posters of Slipknot, Korn, Children of Bodom, Cradle of Filth, etc. Our state being primarily a Christian state, and the seniors being a very religious bunch, they took down all my posters and prayed for me. I was still shaken up from the night's incident, and I was feeling very apprehensive about sleeping in my room again. Luckily, my parents were passing through town that day, on their way to the next district for some work. I called them up, had them come pick me up, and I spent a week away to clear my head. After my break, when I returned, nothing creepy ever happened again. I completed my 12th grade without any more incidents, and left for college elsewhere. Holy Horror, aka Holy Hell, from Gary D. I'm not so sure this is a good idea, you know, to crack open the lid of this long-buried casket again. Just the thought of reopening this mental cage, with its many massive psychological coping mechanism padlocks that firmly secure it, makes my skin crawl. This is one of those very painful, suppressed memories that your brain does everything it possibly can to protect you from, by providing a kind of mental insulation, or throwing up a smokescreen to help you not have to deal with it, and thereby preserve your sanity. That being said, I really wish that this was just some whimsical BS, a made-up story from my imagination, but it's not. The bizarre crap that happened to me back then has probably twisted my mind and soul into whatever crazy contorted balloon animal psychosis I'm suffering from today. What I do know is that what I'm about to tell you has not been uttered nor discussed with anyone since the time it all happened. None of those around me today, whether it be close family or friends, are even remotely aware of this part of my nightmarish childhood. And hopefully, by me recounting it now, it doesn't somehow send out some sort of signal or prime the pump to suddenly release a flood of disturbing memories. And even more importantly, that it doesn't bring back the demonic spirit of her again, so that she can continue on with her torment and vicious psychological torturing of me. Yes, I have a very creepy childhood memory that still haunts me. Even though it happened to me many decades ago, the associated lingering sharp psychological sting and residual damage to my mind still remain, just like recognizing even the slightest hint of a familiar smell in the air, which then immediately reminds you of something from your childhood. She always manages to find me, usually in my dreams, or rather, my nightmares. Back when I was just a young lad of about 14 or 15, I was involved in the typical stupid, risky behavior that many young males of our species are known for. Throwing caution to the wind, me and my two best friends at the time fearlessly took on all and any dares or challenges. We thought we were invincible. At the time and at that early age, none of the three of us had gone down the alcohol or mind-altering drug road yet. Bored as we often were, we would search out new challenges and ridiculous things to do. Living in the Great Lakes region, in a city located right on the shore of Lake Ontario, we often walked the shoreline, hoping to stumble across something unique or interesting, like maybe the washed-up body of some googly-eyed alien, or a person. But alas, the odds were not stacked in our favor in those regards. Very close to where we all lived stood a stretch of very steep sand cliffs. Towering roughly 200 feet high, the cliff face dropped off rather abruptly, straight into the lake. With there being just enough of a sandy slope to allow three rambunctious young boys to carefully shimmy down. It was composed of dense, compressed sand. It had the consistency similar to packed winter snow. Hundreds, if not thousands, of swallows called this area home, having carefully pecked and clawed out nesting holes along the sides of these cliffs. Naturally, we boys lowered ourselves down the side of the sandy cliff face in order to get a closer look at the swallows and their nests. On one of these occasions, we discovered a very large hole, which appeared to be the opening to a fairly sizable tunnel. What pterodactyl-type giant monstrosity of a bird made this big hole? Our immature little minds must have thought. We quickly realized that the gaping sandy orifice was indeed plenty big enough to allow any one of us to crawl inside. A new adventure. I can't remember who had the gall to go in first, but whoever it was stuck their body halfway in before quickly pulling it back out again. It was way too dark in there, and who knows what the heck is lying in wait, excitedly licking its jagged fangs, anxious and eager to rip off a pubescent boy's head, or maybe a couple of pubescent boys' heads. We decided to return the next day so we could bring a candle, a small plastic plate to stand on, and a trusty Bic lighter. Without telling our parents, of course, we went back there early that next morning. I remember our giddy excitement as we pondered what horrible beast or freak of nature may be laying inside. Dave volunteered to go first, and we remaining two didn't fight him for the bragging rights of this endeavor. Dave's upper body slid into the earthy womb, whilst sliding a short, stubby lit candle in front of him on the small plastic plate. Then we saw just the soles of his ratty old sneakers twitching before he finally disappeared altogether. We called out to him a couple of times, and all we heard back was,
"So cool."
He told us that just inside the main entrance, he'd crawled through a short, tight tunnel, which led to an opening where there was a small, crudely carved out cave on either side, right and left. Each was like a very small room, roughly 4 feet high and about 5 feet in diameter. He yelled to us that his candle had blown out a couple of times and that he had to fumble around to relight it. After not hearing anything from him for another couple of minutes, we called into the hole.
What else do you see?
And, Are you okay? His muffled reply sounded distant as it echoed and bounced along the earthen walls and through the curving tunnels.
"I just crawled through another longer tunnel, and it ended up in a lower ceilinged but much deeper cave."
Even at that young age, I already hated the nauseating feeling associated with claustrophobia. To be suffocatingly squeezed into a very confined spot, like a piece of human meat tightly wrapped up in a giant burrito, minus the refried beans and rice, of course. There was a brief silence. Then we suddenly heard Dave yell out,
"What the heck? There's something in here with me."
"What is it?"
We responded.
"It's something pretty small. I'm not sure. Maybe a skunk or a raccoon. I can see its yellow glowing eye staring back at me, and there's this awful stink, like something died in here."
Rob and I looked at each other, crinkling our noses, as if the two of us could smell whatever the heck it was that was decomposing in there. Suddenly, Dave popped back out from the hole like a rabid gopher who had just been chased out of hell having wild eyes and his mouth hanging wide open. He looked white as a sheet and seemed to stutter a bit before finally squeaking out in a half-whisper and half-shrieky voice, sounding kind of strained, like he was constipated and struggling with a stubborn bowel movement.
"It's not an animal. I don't know what the heck it is. It almost looks human. One of you go in there and take a look."
Rob and I laughed, saying that it was probably just a scared squirrel. Rob grabbed the candle out of Dave's hand, relit it, and then headed right in. Dave sat there quietly in the sand, which was not normal for him. His eyes were bulging wide open, and his mouth was positioned in a permanent O. After about 5 minutes, Rob crawled back out, handing me the candle, and basically barking.
"You gotta take a look at this thing."
"What'd you see in there?" I replied.
"I have no freaking idea. It's some freaky-looking thing. It almost looks like one of those vintage dolls, like a tattered doll of a creepy old witch, maybe. But what the heck? I could hear it moving, and its yellow eyes kept blinking, and it's making some screwed-up, wheezy breathing sound. It's your turn to go in. You can tell us what the heck it is."
And even though the very furthest point within the whole tunnel system was maybe only about 10 feet in from the main entrance, in the mind of a terrified 15-year-old boy who's slowly crawling along in the pitch darkness on all fours and nervously pushing a dimly lit candle in front of him, it felt a heck of a lot more like it was 100 feet. Unfortunately, at the time, mobile phones didn't yet exist, as the brightness of the screen, or even better yet, the flashlight feature, would have made handling this situation a whole lot easier. My heart started to race, and my mouth went dry, like suddenly being struck by a lightning bolt. I had this overwhelming feeling of pending doom, and it had absolutely nothing to do with being scared of whatever bloody rodent was hiding in that cave. It was the thought of utter dread, the chest-tightening fear of getting wedged in one of those tunnels, constricted, feeling like some giant anaconda had wrapped itself around me, crushing my ribs, slowly squeezing the life out of me, and methodically suffocating me one breath at a time. My head started spinning, and I felt like I was going to pass out. Then my next thought was, what if the sand roof suddenly just gives way and everything caves in? Would I immediately be crushed to death, or would I just lay there suffering for a long time, unable to breathe, waiting in agony for my heart to stop beating and for the last of my brain cells to die? Would it feel like my body was being stabbed by a million pins before slowly going cold after the initial barrage of excruciating pain signals to the brain had eventually subsided? Or would I be lucky enough to die instantly? The guys taunted me, calling me a wussy, trying to persuade me to go in by saying, "Grow a pair and man up." Not wanting to have this hanging over my head for years to come, and from then on be labeled a wimp or coward, I sucked it up and I grabbed the candle. "Breathe," I thought to myself. "Just breathe." My brain felt like it was on fire, and my entire body suddenly seemed to be made of lead. I took another deep breath and made my way into the tunnel entrance. I could feel my heartbeat pounding in my throat as I slowly inched my way forward through the first little tunnel. I was marginally relieved once I reached the opening, revealing the two small caves to the left and right. I held the candle up and surveyed the bowels of this sandy labyrinth. I saw nothing exciting, just the scrape marks in the walls made by whatever tool was used to create this passageway and caves.
"What's happening?"
someone yelled from outside.
"Do you see her yet? Do you see her?"
No, I responded. "I haven't gotten that far yet."
The flame on the wick of my candle started to flicker like crazy, and then seemed to grow taller and shine brighter.
"I'm going further in now,"
I practically screamed. That second tunnel was much tighter and considerably longer than the first. I stopped a few times, allowing my mind to torture me by replaying the sardine trapped in a tin can scenario over and over again in my head. I tried to think happy thoughts, but it didn't work, so I kept pushing forward. Finally, after what seemed like half an hour, but was really probably 5 minutes, I reached the opening that led into the furthest cave enclosure
I was breathing heavily then, so I sat there for a minute or so to get it together. Once I was a bit calmer, I lifted the plate holding the shrinking candle up out in front of me. Like the guys had said, this last room had a much lower ceiling, but stretched deeper into the cliffside. I remember crawling further forward and moving the candle from side to side. Suddenly, there it was. At first, at the very far corner, I saw the bright canary yellow eyes staring right at me and occasionally blinking. Then there was some movement. What really disturbed me was the cracking sound it made, like tiny tree branches or twigs snapping. And then there was that putrid smell of death. For whatever stupid reason, I decided to nudge forward so I could get a better look. I guess, somehow, in some magical way, I must have grown a large pair while I was in there. Moving up a few more feet made all the difference. By candlelight, I could now clearly see the mystery critter. My eyes must have grown 3 sizes that day. There, cowering in the far corner, was a living, breathing, human-like creature. I guess it was only about 2 feet tall or so, and it resembled a withered-up witch, a leathery-skinned hag with the already mentioned yellow eyes. But it also had long, frizzled hair, a wrinkled-up apple doll face, an elongated nose, and a partially open mouth, revealing an assortment of fang-like, crooked yellow teeth. As mentioned earlier, no alcohol, no hallucinogenic drugs, nor psychosis was involved here. I sat there, hunched over, in a kind of catatonic state, afraid to move and provoke her. To be honest, I was basically crapping myself, thinking there's no way this is real. There's just no freaking way. It has to be some sort of battery-operated witch doll with glowing yellow eyes that blinked, limbs that moved, and that came with an optional smells-like-death scent feature. I heard the guys yell again, asking,
"Do you see her? What the heck is it?"
I was afraid to answer, not knowing what she or it would do. Finally, after it dawned on me again as to exactly where I was, being tightly crammed inside the unsafe sand infrastructure of a towering cliff, I just wanted to get the heck out. I backed away slowly, panting, keeping a close eye on the freaky-looking witch thing, hoping that it wouldn't move. And as I backed up, heading towards the tunnel to make my escape, the creepiest thing that I've probably ever experienced happened. The demon witch devil doll thing, whatever the heck you want to call it, suddenly perked up and came to life by sitting up straight, then with its body turned completely sideways, quickly scuttled towards me by running up the side of the cave wall and then upside down along the ceiling, all the while accompanied by a nauseating sound, which I would best describe as resembling that of a giant enraged Dungeness crab running across a cobblestone road towards me. That creepy as heck hollow shell, crustacean castanets-like sound still haunts me to this very day. As it ran towards me, I screamed like I just realized that I was spontaneously combusting. My heart was beating out of my chest, and I made it out of the entire tunnel system much faster than I would have expected. Once I managed to crawl out of the main entrance/exit hall, I just kept running. I didn't speak with my friends until later that day, when they came by my house to find out what happened. I told them the story, and we were all scared crapless. What we didn't know at the time was that one of our parents had overheard one of us talking about it. They were concerned about how unsafe these sand cliff tunnels and caves were, and ended up calling the police about it. Maybe a week later, the three of us worked up enough courage to go back and just stand near the tunnel entrance. To our surprise, the whole cliff side was now gone. As we found out later, the city had arranged to have this dangerous and potentially unsafe tunnel system demolished with the use of dynamite. The three of us only spoke about it a few times shortly afterwards, and then unanimously decided to bury this horrifying incident in our memories forever. As fate would have it, Rob suddenly and quite unexpectedly passed away in his 30s, and Dave, by way of a massive heart attack, died in his early 40s. Like I said, she revisits me from time to time in my dreams, and unfortunately, I have woken up many times with my heart racing
drenched in a cold sweat due to the relentless sound of castanets echoing in my head.
Sag mal, hast du bei der Steuer auch diesen Schulflashback? Einfach irgendwas raten und dann hoffen, dass es stimmt?
Boah, nee, gar nicht. Wieso, Steuer ist so mein Safe Space.
Du meinst, damit ist alles sicher?
Ja, genau. Wieso, Steuer ist so die Steuer-App, die dich einfach versteht. Egal ob Studium, Job oder Umzug.
Stimmt, krass. Fühlt sich gar nicht wie Steuern an.
Steuern erledigt?
Safe.
Mit Wieso Steuer.
Father and Son Lake UFO. From the Ungrateful Dead. A quick side note before I begin. This is, as much as I wish it wasn't, not the only, the worst, or the most chilling experience, more specifically sighting, that I have gone through. Instead, this is the first, as it is the first that I will be sharing with you. Throughout my life, there has always been something off surrounding me, and I love to tell people about these events. I look forward to the future stories I may share. So for now, let's begin with this one. I live on the east coast of Massachusetts. My house and a lake next to us are separated by a hill and a road. Not much. The lake is big, starting with a cove around 300 yards from the hill's end, which is backed up by the rest of the lake behind and to the left of it. I have a small family. My parents don't play huge roles in this, nor does my younger brother, who I'll refer to as H, for the sake of privacy. At the time, I was 12, and you can call me F. It was my brother's birthday, and as we did when we were younger, we chose to spend those days away from each other's presence. I was away at my father's house, while he was having a sleepover with two of his friends. The day went fine, but around 6 p.m. he called us, asking for the Nintendo Switch. So we grabbed it for him, and we drove all the way over to my mom's house. We dropped it off, and my dad was only a little annoyed by this. We drove back, and commenced where we left off. It was around 6:45 when we got another phone call. Apparently, we had forgotten to drop off all the controllers for the Nintendo Switch. So I grabbed them, and we drove all the way back down to our mom's house. My dad was mumbling something under his breath on the way over. Nothing I could understand or hear. We dropped them off, but when I went inside, I saw his cake. Now, every year since I was 1 year old, my father had made his famous chocolate cake. Raspberries or strawberries in the middle, chocolate drizzle everywhere, double layer. I saw a loose piece and I remember thinking clearly. I just spent an hour of my life driving around so my brother can play video games. I'm taking this as sales tax. So I grabbed the piece of cake, wrapped it in saran wrap, and left after dropping off my brother's stuff. I hopped in the car and we were halfway back to my dad's house when guess what? The phone rang again. My dad grumbled and told me to look at it. I grabbed the phone, opened it, and the piece of cake I took was one of G's friend's pieces. I awkwardly sat there thinking about how my dad would react, and I was too lazy to make it sound nicer. I said something along the lines of, "Guess what? The piece of cake I took was J's." So now he was fuming. We turned back, and it must have been at least 8 o'clock at the time. It was getting really dark, so by the time I had returned the parcel of cake, it was pitch black. I could make out a telephone pole about 50 yards away, but I couldn't see any details, for instance. I went back outside and into the car. I was exhausted, and my dad probably was too. I remember thinking we should just go back and sleep, so I jumped into the back seat and nothing. Normally, my dad would keep the car running just so we could go a bit faster. But the car was off, and he was sitting in the driver's seat, just staring at something in the distance. "Dad?" I remember calling to him, and he hesitated for a second before giving me a look I now recognize as, "If I show you this, it will help me, but it will hurt you." Then whispered, "Quick, come up here," and had me position myself in the passenger seat, leaning forward from the back seat. His expression was a mixture of awe and confusion. He pointed to the night sky. "There, do you see it?" He resumed his staring contest with the night sky. But then I saw it. Lights. Around 7 to 10 of them in a perfectly straight line, making no sound, heading out towards the night sky over our lake. They moved as one, coming from what was most likely a horizontal line. They were curving straight up, and the lights were off too. They cast nothing off of them, no glare or anything. Just these balls of light heading into the clouds. Do you see it? He asked. I nodded my head, not wanting to take my eyes off of them. They moved fast, not like a jet, but like they had no time to spare. When the last orb disappeared, we drove back without saying a word. I assure you I was exhausted, but I didn't sleep. Instead, I thought about people's UFO stories in a new light, the strings light. That morning, my dad woke me up and said he had found out what had happened, or what had allegedly happened. He believed it was just a SpaceX satellite launch. That sat well with me until I figured out that SpaceX satellites have a minimum of 40 probes, don't start off horizontally, have a glare because of sun reflection or moon reflection, and to seal the deal, they didn't do any launches at the time in my area. So what we actually saw, I don't know, and I'm not sure I want to. A Surprise Underneath the Sofa, from Kisu. I grew up as a weird kid who was obsessed with werewolves at the age of 6, tried to conjure aliens to appear above my home at the age of 9, and who pondered the possibilities of parallel universes at the age of 12. This was long before the internet existed, when the only way to get information was to find a library and read. Of course, the next natural step on this trajectory was to get into divination. I made my first runes at the age of 16 from a thin alder branch, just thick enough for me to be able to get round, flat runes out of them, and drew each rune symbol carefully on a piece of paper with a marker, then glued them on the alder pieces. Since my first runes, I have gotten into oracle cards, tarot, and divination by amulets, postcards, even coins. I earned part of my living with divination orders when I was studying, and I'm still a part-time oracle, for lack of a better word, because I don't feel that a medium or a psychic really fits me as a description. However you want to label me, I can say that I'm used to all kinds of weird occurrences happening, and I know the gimmicks of the spirit world inside out, from poltergeists to possessions, from past lives to astral traveling. But this one event in my life took even me by surprise. My apartment is a small studio apartment, enough to fit in a bed, a sofa, and a living room table, which altogether take up half the living space. My bed is positioned to the right-hand side from the sofa and the living room table. My sofa and the table work as my working space for all my needs. I write, get letters and postcards ready, eat, draw, design, sort items, organize my sticker collection, study, talk with online friends, plan, and do all my work tasks, including those times when I'm filling my clients' divination orders. Pretty much everything that happens in my life outside sleeping happens on this spot. The divination process itself is simple. I introduce the client to the spiritual world, tell what they want to know, and then shuffle decks until the reading is done. Unlike mini readers, my way of working with the decks is what I call freestyle. I shuffle and shuffle, and let the cards fly out from the deck on their own. Because of this method, sometimes some rogue cards fly out and go hiding underneath the table or the sofa without me noticing them. I usually spot them the next day at the least, albeit sometimes a week has passed when I found a lonely card hiding on the floor. If there are multiple rogue cards, they're always scattered haphazardly here and there. Sideways, upside down, turned up, turned down facing the floor, on top of each other, and so on. I had a really busy day this particular day when the incident happened. It was mid-July, 2024. I've been working with client orders for hours, because I had a special July sale on my online store, and reading orders were pouring in. I had been using almost all of my decks to answer various questions, and to give assistance to people when they wanted to know something about themselves, or what decision would be the best one in their case. One particular client had a question about their love life, the most popular question I got of all time. So for this client's case, I used an oracle card deck, specifically meant for love-related inquiries. It's a pink deck with romantic paintings of couples, often accompanied by cherubs, and underneath every painting is a word for the card and a short description for the card's topic, such as Passion, allow your heart and soul to sing with joy. This specific deck was a new one in my ever-growing deck collection. I had gotten it as a Christmas present from my sister last year, so I had not used it much yet. It was a little wild one, often making cards fly all over the place while shuffling, throwing the cards around with such force that I had to pick up cards meant for a client's reading off from the floor. Trust me when I say that every single deck has a personality of its own, and they don't always come along with you or are in the mood to work. Ask about this with anyone who deals with divination, and they will tell you the same. When I finally got all the client cases done for that day, I gathered my cards, put them back in their cases, and placed them in their own storage space in my drawer, where I store all other spiritually related items too, like sage, crystals and stones, runes, amulets, special magical oils and salves, candles and spell items. I was happy that the day had been so productive, and I especially wished that the client with the love-related question had gotten what they asked for, especially when the deck I used was still new to me, and I was getting familiar with it. I continued my day normally, and went to bed when the day was over, as usual. Next afternoon, while sitting on the sofa, I got an urge to go to a grocery store, which is located half a mile from my home. Strange, I thought, because I had no particular need for anything from the store. But I decided to follow this inner calling anyway. If nothing else, I could always stock up on something I would use, and besides that, I could get a little walk done outside. I got up from the sofa, getting ready to leave. I was thinking, what should I actually stock from the supermarket? Maybe get something big and heavy or something small and easy to carry? Do I need to take a backpack with me? Or will just a regular shopping tote be sufficient? Right then, I noticed something on the floor. Underneath the sofa, just at the edge, which I can only see if I sit at the right spot, there were cards, two of them. They were from the Romance Oracle deck I was using yesterday for the client's reading. Like I said, finding rogue cards which have somehow slipped past me while shuffling is nothing unusual. But these cards weren't normal. Instead of me discovering these rogue cards from their usual spots where they typically fly, these two cards were on a spot where cards can't fall. Besides that, they weren't haphazardly spread here and there. No. These were aligned with one another, neatly placed side by side, their picture sides up, facing towards me. To add a cherry on top of this weird thing I was seeing, a sticker of a cat was placed on top of one of the cards. Not any sticker of any cat. This was an image of a cat who was in love. This cute Japanese sticker, which was a leftover from my sticker collection, its paws pressed against its chest, with a small smile and a heart dangling above its head. I couldn't believe my eyes. First of all, I had not noticed missing cards the day before when I used the deck, albeit it was possible I'd missed two cards, and they had actually fallen while shuffling. When I shuffle decks, the cards fall in front of me, not to my sides. These cards were on the right-hand side where I sit on the sofa while working, and for cards to even fall that far, they would need to fly over the sofa's handrest and then curve back underneath the sofa. I had never had any cards fly over the handrest. Second, these cards were from the Romance deck, and the cat sticker was also a love-related sticker. Too suspicious to be a mere coincidence. Third, I had no memory of the last time I had seen that leftover cat sticker. I remember that I sorted that specific sticker box months ago, maybe even last year in November. And since the box contained 5 pieces of each design, I only took one of each of my collection and placed the rest in their box. I have no idea where this sticker came from now, and how this sticker had actually found its way on top of the cards. I was so surprised that I actually went for my phone and took a picture of this, all before touching the cards. After documenting what I was seeing, I reached for the cards. This was clearly a message meant for me, even when I had not asked for any messages or signs. This had to be an important one, since there were 2 cards and a sticker placed on one, like it was emphasizing, "Hey you, pay attention to this." When I reached out for the cards, I realized something shocking. There weren't just 2 cards. There were 5, These were not two cards, but two piles of cards, placed so precisely on top of one another that the cards underneath the top cards were not visible. Absolutely impossible for rogue cards. Someone would have had to take my cards, place them in two neat piles next to one another, with an upright position facing me, snug the cards underneath my sofa, at an exact spot which is only visible from one place, the spot where I typically sit when getting ready to leave the house. Then look for a sticker, choose a cat and love sticker from my hundreds of leftover stickers to match the Romance Oracle card deck, and put the sticker on top of the cards. Anyway, I spread the cards on the floor in front of me. It spelled, New Love, Attraction, Romantic Feelings, Honeymoon, Release Your Ex. The two cards on top of the piles read, The time has come to clear your energy, and Enjoy the bliss of holiday time together. The remaining three cards underneath these two said, Your feelings are real and worth exploring. You attract romantic love by enjoying this moment fully. And a new person has stirred your romantic feelings. The thing is that I have been single my whole adult life. I've never been married, when people my age are often in their second marriage, or have been married at least once. I had a boyfriend when I was young, but he was an immature jerk. I didn't even have any crushes at the time. So I took the message as, get ready, someone's arriving and you'll meet him the easiest by enjoying your life. The past experiences are now past. After I discovered the cards with the sticker from the floor, I never put the cards back in their case with the others. They're in a separate space in my drawer. The cat sticker is also a special item for me now. I've saved it, placing it near my home altar to remind me to stay positive and happy. While I consider myself very knowledgeable regarding anything paranormal, I still don't know who sent me this message. I know it must have happened when I was sleeping. No, I don't sleepwalk, never have, although I apparently mutter in my sleep and toss and turn a lot. But who had their fingers on my cards? If I had to guess, I would point my finger at my belated grandmother from my father's side. But it can as well be my spirit guide, Ian, someone else from this family line who I don't know like a great-great-great-aunt, a past-life loved one who has not been born but resides in the afterlife as a spirit. Or just some spirit passing by. I'm used to getting signs and synchronicity like numbers, items, words, songs, dreams, images, videos. Once I found three different colored roses lying on a street I've taken the last 10 years without ever seeing any flowers. But this experience is a one-of-a-kind thing. I'm still single a year after receiving this message, so I hope I'm following its guidance right. The evil types of witches are so creepy. Why is it that wizards ain't got nothing on witches? Just think about it. If the Wizard of the Woods had it out for me, I'd probably just give him a swirly in my toilet and have him on his way. But there's something about a witch, a woman in touch with magic, that keeps you scared of the idea of making her mad. Good night. Hey, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Unexplained Encounters. I'm your host, Darkness Prevails. And you people gotta start leaving comments about what I should do for the Halloween special. Is there gonna be a Halloween special? I don't know. I'm honestly creatively bankrupt at this point. Podcasting and YouTubing for a living will do that to your brain. So I'll try to figure something out. And if y'all leave some comments for inspiration, I would be mighty grateful. Thank you. Till next time, everyone. Stay safe out there and stay creepy. Because this world is a strange one.
Verwandle deine Leidenschaft mit Shopify in ein Business und knack Umsatzrekorde mit dem Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Du hast richtig gehört. Der Checkout mit der weltweit besten Conversion. Der legendäre Checkout von Shopify vereinfacht das Shoppen auf deiner Website bis hin zu Social Media und überall dazwischen. Na, das ist Musik für deine Ohren. Wie du es auch drehst und wendest, mit Shopify kannst du zu einem echten Hit werden. Starte deinen Test noch heute für nur 1 Euro pro Monat auf shopify.de/rekorde.